Hi, and welcome to the VFX Show. I'm Mike Seymour, and joined pleasantly and nearly always by Jason Diamond. How are you, Jason?
Effusively great.
And the ever eloquent Matt Wallen.
I am doing well, thank you.
So we're here to talk about Spider-Man Brand New Day, which, as I think we'd all agree, Tom Holland's having a bit of a week, kind of looking rather good, given that the only film that was close to outgunning him at the box office was, another film of his, The Odyssey. So, not looking too shabby at that point.
Another film of his, Bernthal and Zendaya's.
Yes. Though we'd have to say that this one is Tom's film, as in he really is carrying the majority of the acting and the weight. Though I would say the interest around the film is enormously fueled by he and Zendaya.
Totally. I mean, the MJ lore, you know, MJ is it, you know, for Spider-Man on top of other people. But, you know, it's a great love story that's gone through all the comics, you know.
So let's start, before we get into the visual effects, by discussing the film. And I'll go first to you, Matt. Like, did you enjoy the film? I mean, this is the fourth in this current, like, run of Spider-Man.
Yeah, I guess that's right. I don't have a great recall for these kind of movies, really. They don't always, like, stick with me. So a lot of times visuals stick with me. And I think, you know, I saw it this morning at my local theater here in Richmond, and it has some great visual moments in it. I do like Tom Holland. I like Zendaya. I like Mark Ruffalo is in this as well. The guy, is his name Tillman, who plays
Ned.
Metzger, he's in Severance.
Trammell Tillman.
Yeah, Trammell Tillman, yeah. I think. And it was great to see him in a feature film role, mm-hmm. where he played. And then the Sadie Sink actor playing the role she plays, I thought she was really good, and she had some good emotional moments in the film. There was one thing, though, I have to say about this movie that I found troubling. From a cinematic standpoint, terms of like just experiencing a movie, that where New York City, I'm wearing my Mets cap. I thought it was great too, by the way, that Peter Parker is a Mets fan, which is a sad thing for anyone who is a Mets fan.
He's from Queens, bro.
Yeah, so he's got to be a Mets fan. But
mythology completely lost on me, but keep going.
I mean, I was just up there visiting our son who's there, and it was great, you know, spending a couple of days in New York. I guess one of the things, you know, as movies are kind of have to chase, studios have to chase tax incentives, right, in order to bring in the film at a lower budget. You know, this movie's doing, you know, gangbusters at the box office. So a lot of this film, even the stuff taking place in New York, felt like it was shot elsewhere. And we have a digital version of New York. And then from the cinematography standpoint, the limitations on the kind of lighting that they were able to get in some of these studio environments, as well as, I think, some digital backdrops and stuff, maybe some composites in there too. I felt like it made the world feel hermetic in a way that, like, it didn't breathe the way that, like, when you're in New York, you know, it smells like pot everywhere and piss and in the summer.
I was going to say those plumes of steam that somehow come out of the pavement for no apparent reason. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There's something hot under there. The chud, you know, is down there somewhere. But, you know, and so for me, like, the New York, there's like a corner that's clearly a set where they have it kind of a vanishing point. There are streets like that in New York, but they're few and far between. And the way that one's set up, it's very much a back lot kind of setup. And it wasn't until the end of the movie, 2 hours and 25 minutes in, when they cut away from the action and they go to the above the line credits, mm-hmm. and they're all shot against beautifully composed, naturally lit, sunlit, and some at night, mm-hmm. so the sodium vapor lights or whatever, you know, light LED lighting and stuff in the proper skyline of New York, and they're gorgeous shots, absolutely beautiful. And some of them even with like a really fast lens and a shallow depth of field and just so many different images as they're showing all the above the line credits. And I just thought, like, why didn't they shoot the movie like that? Like, it looks so good. And that would bring the other important part of the whole Spider-Man story. Like when we were in New York, we went to a Mets game at Citi Field, and it was Spider-Man Day. They had a Spider-Man t-shirt, which we didn't get there early enough to get the Spider-Man t-shirt. But like people were dressed in the Spider-Man costume. There were girls and guys like on the 7 train going out to the stadium dressed in Spider-Man stuff. And it's so cool. Like he's a New York character. They should shoot this movie in New York proper. And to not do that is to me, it's a wasted opportunity. And it made the film, well, it had entertaining moments and there were some
less authentic perhaps.
Well, just made it sort of suffocated it a little bit for me in terms of the world. The world felt small in a way that I don't.
Whenever you
think
get an alley scene, and the alley scene where he does the stretching, for example, they never feel like their actual exteriors, do they? They feel like they're.
But it was okay otherwise.
Yeah, Jason, what did you think of the film before we get into a breakdown of the lighting?
I don't disagree with Matt. I did feel a lot of the digital environments that they didn't bother me per se because it's a superhero movie and it's kind of par for the course. But I agree that there is an opportunity to come to New York, employ a lot of people in New York. The movie is going to make like $2 billion or something. Money is certainly not the issue here, especially after what they've spent on like Doomsday at like $700 million or some nonsense. So yes, I agree. It's also a wasted opportunity. I think in the credits, I saw a lot of Quebec stuff. So they probably went up to, you know, various towns in Canada. I believe there was some stuff from Glasgow we saw in BTS or something.
So you think they crossed the maple curtain and went onto to the other side of your
I mean, everyone does. I mean, that's neighbor. Toronto and
yeah, but I mean, you know, America is almost at war with Canada. It seems surprising that you would give the not in the movies. Such a
yeah. Well, not most Americans I know aren't at war with Canada.
Yeah, no, I was just in Toronto in July. It's great.
Just the crazies.
Yeah.
Lots of Canadians using their elbows is all I see. Anyway, go on.
Go for it. But from a plot perspective review, I enjoyed it thoroughly. There's a little bit of a big exposition dump in the first act, which was like fine. But once it kicked in, like I felt incredibly satisfied as a deep Spider-Man fan. I like the other Spider-Men, but I love Tom Holland as Spider-Man. And I think that they've really captured their actual Peter Parker-ness of the character with Tom Holland. The plot for me worked really well. I was really excited about a third of the way in the movie when I realized that the trailer was a total head fake of the plot and that it wasn't about that it wasn't about the ninja guys and another like kind of League of Shadows type, you know, thing. And, which was about was just giving me, you know, Dark Knight Rises or whatever third Nolan Batman movie, you know, butterflies in my stomach that we were about to get a subpar.
Well, did you not see all that stuff on Reddit and on the internet about how they clearly had removed characters like they had from the last Spider-Man because that all the ninjas weren't looking at exactly where Tom Holland's character was or Tom Holland's Spider-Man was. And clearly there were other characters that had been erased and there were like massive conspiracy theories.
Yeah, well, because they were going on because, and that leads me to my other thing that I really liked, they did a really good job of nailing, for people who don't know it subconsciously, because they're great compositions, but for people who do know them, in all the Spidey, like in that montage sequence of him fighting all the guys over like a couple years and really seeing him be Spider-Man in New York City, every time he fought somebody, like they were literally copying a, you know, a comic cover or like key art of Spider-Man. You can go online and find where people did the overlays of stuff. And it's like, that to me is amazing because not only are you getting the real vibe of Spider-Man and the action, but you're also paying homage to these incredible compositions that these artists had done prior that are, you know, well-known and whatever. And I think someone had made the analogy that sort of wider shot of the Ninja Guys was a cover where someone else was in it in that cover, and they only replicated like half of the frame from the cover. So people were surmising that it had been removed because of the analogy. But I don't, I mean, yeah. Who knows?
Is that the one where it's from the side and they're, yeah, the like side they're one. Forming like a staircase well, kind of yeah. almost walking?
In the trailer, that's outside, right? Isn't there a shot that's like in a much wider environment and it's not in the jail cell? Remember. But anyway,
that's a good point.
Anyway,
what I liked about that is your point that you just mentioned, right? Which is that if you didn't know that, you didn't mind. And if you did know that, you got a nod. What I don't like is when they include things that are obscure just for the fans, that the rest of us are like, I didn't need that. I like that quite a lot. I thought, as you say, the head fake was terrific that they didn't give everything away in the trailer, because I went and saw it as soon as it opened. And so I didn't know that. I didn't know. Spoilers for anyone that hasn't seen it, you should definitely stop the recording now, our playback now. But anyway, I didn't know that there was going to be any kind of link to X-Men. And so I was genuinely surprised, but also curious as to what the heck was going on at the beginning of the film. Like, who is he fighting? Who is this force? Like, what's going on? So I thought it was good. And also, I didn't want to see Scorpion as the main villain, because I was like, well, that just seems like a Doc Ock with one arm behind his back kind of thing. You know what I mean?
It was just the actor that played that guy, wasn't he the guy who was like Gus Fring's hitman kind of character from Better Call Saul or Breaking
Great.
Bad?
Yeah, he's great.
He was good. It was and cool also, to see that guy. I was like, hey, I know that guy.
The other thing I was concerned about from the trailer is, you know, and we'll get into the how they pull it off, but the effects where, the sequence where you end up with a whole lot of falling debris, Hulk is in the debris and Spider-Man is jumping up through it. And I was like, if this is going to be one of those ridiculous, break every law of physics, ridiculous kind of super over the top action sequence things that just are mind-numbingly boring after a while, I'm not going to enjoy the film. And that was one shot or one sequence in the whole film that did that, where you had like, you know, he was leaping literally from debris to debris up as debris fell down kind of thing.
Although I would say of so many of the different effects sequences, I think from a lighting standpoint and an integration standpoint into like a much more natural feeling version of New York, like it's the building is... what is it called? Like damage control,
which
is the funniest name for government agency or whatever. But I actually thought that sequence was one of where we're looking up the building, we're seeing down the building. And there's even, I think a really big wide shot too, where I think either the Hulk is falling or just
when he's falling.
And you see what the web is doing.
Yeah, but the lighting in that, it was one of the few shots, visual effect shots, where it's clearly a digital, set piece, but it looked more realistic and it looked like it was outside. It had a really hot, direct sunlight that felt really effective. And I thought as a sequence visually, maybe not addressing the physics piece, I don't know, but as a visual storytelling bit, it felt
really
strong.
But can I sort of not throw back at you that the sequence where at the beginning he is dealing with the sort of runaway armored vehicle, like that sequence felt exterior to me. That didn't
totally
feel
they're definitely on a street for that, for sure. I mean, some of it, obviously. Like,
it had been in the trailer a bit.
It just didn't look like New York City to
that I agree with, but it definitely felt outside a lot. Yeah. It just, to your point, I agree. It didn't feel like actual New York.
Before we unpack any more on the visuals, I want to have a good question about its relationship as a business proposition, I guess, to Avengers. So two things I'd like you to comment on. The first one is, I just can't see Endgame outgunning this film at the box office. I think
Doomsday,
Avengers Endgame... Doomsday, sorry, won't outgun it. The other thing was, I went back and watched for this podcast, I went back and watched Endgame, and that is a heck of a good film in terms of, you go, oh, that's a good sequence. Oh, there's a sequence coming up, that's a good sequence. Oh, I love this bit here. I love that gag there kind of thing. Like, it is not just a star vehicle. It's punch
Which
after
one
punch.
Which one is Endgame? What is that, where the snap happens, or...?
It's the conclusion of that entire Thor sequence. It starts out, Thor sequence. Thanos sequence. It starts out with them already having had half of it, and the snap has happened. People have disappeared.
Endgame was the second half of the whatever the name of the film was before that. It was like a two-part. Yeah,
and they start building up. And then they were time jump back into getting... So art department had a ball, right? They kept on recreating and bringing back terrific cameos of people that you'd only seen in, you know, odd things. But because they were going back in time, they could touch on so many films. And then you had just a kick-ass action sequence of the giant battle at the end. And I did think that in terms of cinematic kind of drama and just big box office superheroes, that it outgunned this film. So I was just interested because now we've got this whole thing about this film being either as big or bigger than that Avengers film. I just wanted you to comment whether you think – go on.
I'm going to say that they're not super comparable. Endgame and whatever the one was before it, I mean, they were the culmination of like 40 films or whatever it was, you know, for phase one or two or wherever we were in the Marvel MCU. And the Russos, and I think arguably those two movies are the Russos' best films they may ever make and or write. I think they wrote them too. But the reason I think it works and is not specifically comparable to this is that movie's task was near impossible to combine the tones of every character's solo vehicle and combo vehicles they had to that point and maintain that in a collaborative, group of actors that all need to keep their tones while interacting with each other, not clashing the tones, and within a new narrative that all drives forward. And I believe I said this at the time when we did that show too, that is a Herculean task. And the fact that they pulled it off so well on top of the action and the story and all that, that's why those movies are good. This is a single kind of movie that I think one of the reason it's doing better is because the movies post-Endgame were not as cohesive and good because they began falling into this time manipulation hole that people I don't think ultimately really liked, and the movies suffered slightly for it, the multiverse stuff. And this is, I think, the first movie we have from an MCU that is not specifically focused on that multiverse, and Doomsday is the last movie in the multiverse. So they have not only a budgetary problem to overcome, but they have a story problem to overcome because they have to overcome the albatross of phase four, whatever, that shit is.
Multiverse sickness.
That's my feeling.
I would just say I think this movie is and will be, from what I can see so far, a bigger movie for a whole bunch of reasons. I mean, it functions as a standalone movie. Like I don't mean this like in an insulting way or to be dismissive. Like I just don't really remember the other Spider-Mans. Like they all kind of blur together. Like I don't have a brain that is capable of remembering which exact Spider-Man was which. Probably if I was a younger, teenager.
I'm just surprised by that because the other point I was going to raise here is the previous Spider-Man had all the other Spider-Men turn up, right? It's the only film in the multiverse that actually kind of worked, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And it worked
because it plays on the animated ones, the Into the Spider-Verse kind of lore that's in those.
It did, but played on the fact that we'd grown up watching different Spider-Men movies that had been remade. Yeah. And at some point we're all like, this is ridiculous. And then when it happened, it was almost like, oh my God. Obviously they didn't plan felt like they did. Yeah, but having the three of them turn up was a huge – that was a very memorable – for me,
and all
that
their
was a very
villains,
memorable
– And all their villains that came to that they had to – I mean, it was a very, very, very smart
hugely smart
for that characters.
I agree with you. Some of the other ones are like less memorable, but that one I thought was pretty memorable.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just saying, I don't mean it as insulting the movies. I just don't really remember them that well. Cause I go see them cause I'm interested in the visual effects and stuff like that. And cause I have friends who work on them, but I don't really go see them cause I'm a huge fan of those kind of movies, I guess, which I think I probably was a fan when I was, you know, a teenager. I probably would have been super excited and would remember it much better. But I guess what I was going to say about it was just to the question was that I think this is a bigger movie than maybe some of the Avengers movies too, for a host of different reasons. I think the Tom Holland Zendaya thing is a real thing. Like, you know, it's celebrity culture. People are kind of into seeing them. Like, you know, she's the hottest, you know, star in the world, right? He's, you know, the coolest Spider-Man for so many people and stuff. And boy, he looks so much more jacked.
He is jacked.
He's also probably the biggest box office star in the world right now.
Yeah. And so, I just think that it's, you know, it's Spider-Man, it's New York City. It does wind up having a tie-in to other Marvel characters, obviously, which I think is probably fun for like super fans. But even, you know, for me, it was like, oh, it's cool. There's Mark Ruffalo. Oh, that's a cool Hulk. And oh, yeah, she's playing that Jean Grey character. I remember her from those old X-Men movies, the Bryan Singer ones or whatever. and that's cool. Like, but, you know, I could see where. I mean, I sat in the theater. It was a morning screening. It started before 10 a.m. And all these people started coming in. I was sitting right in the middle. And, like, I had, like, these two really older, I mean, I don't mean it to be ages, but two older ladies, like, much older ladies, like, in their 70s, I think, probably. They came and sat right next to me. And I was like, these ladies are coming to see Spider-Man. Like, you know, that's so cool. But I don't know. I think it has a bigger appeal. It has a bigger draw. I think some people maybe shy away from some of those bigger Marvel films or did shy away a broader audience because there's this feeling that you have to know all this other stuff to go see them maybe. And this doesn't really feel that.
Which adds to the baggage or the albatross that you were referring to, Jason, because on top of everything else you mentioned, you have to know what the heck's going on with, quote, the new Avengers, and you have to know what's going on with, you know, Fantastic Four and all the other things that are, maybe I didn't catch that film, and who are they, and what does
it
fit in?
I think someone did a map. It was like 132 hours of stuff to watch that would that would line up like specifically with this Spider-Man movie. Days. And, you know, obviously Daredevil is in the Spider-Man universe, Punisher's in the Spider-Man universe, you know, all those things overlap. X-Men overlap, which I'm super excited about, you know, the Jean Grey stuff and this is the end of this multiverse bullshit. We can get into the X-Men now that Sony and Marvel are actual friends and talking and collaborating as Spider-Man is the bridge for that. You know,
well, you could argue that Sony's in a very strong position now,
100%, but they made a lot of movies that were average over the years for superhero movies. And they very smartly, as for Marvel to play, they played on each other's strengths and they have a very successful Spider-Man franchise, both animated and Tom Holland wise. And that
DC is looking completely anemic by comparison, right? Like,
I mean, they're just starting
Supergirl, Spider-Man.
Yeah. I mean, they're just starting. So they only have two or three properties out. So we'll see how James.
Do we think either of those films, Superman or Supergirl, were really that
they are not
interesting?
Well, I think, I mean, again, if we want to get into the larger thing of it, you don't have a single director, creative, driving MCU. You have Feige, who's a overall story and producer guy, but you have James Gunn driving DC, and he has a very strong creative vision for all of the movies he's made. And currently, we see that same vision in the movies other people have made for the DC universe. So I guess it remains to be seen how much of his actual creative stamp gets put on the DCU rather than just a story observation.
I mean, one of the things that I think really helped Spider-Man, and I'm only occurring to me now as I'm talking to you, is it was small. It was, he doesn't have the ability to fly and to reverse time and like, you know, do amazing, like, global or intergalactic kind of whatever. And so the very
he's a high school kid too. I mean, not in this, but you know, the character is traditionally he's a kid. He's a high school age kid. He's like 16 or 17 or something. And so I think that also makes him more relatable to the target demographic audience for these kind of movies.
I mean, I didn't see Supergirl deliberately because I saw the trailer and I was just like, ugh, that's just not for me.
I haven't. I want to see it. I haven't seen it. I just didn't get around to it, but.
And Superman had the same problem. He goes into some weird alternate something or other, and it was all just ridiculously over the top. And I was like, yeah. Like, it wasn't bad, but it was just too kind of whatever. Everything, like, I remember the earlier Superman films, you know, like, and he sort of, there were literally the destruction of the entire world. And at some point, it just becomes so improbable and so ridiculous. And it's you don't care because no one's, it's just too big. And there's nothing about it that's got, I think, anything to do with kind of interpersonal relationships that have any arc. Because quite frankly, in this film, as much as I really enjoyed the visual effects stuff, I really enjoyed it when Zendaya is talking to Tom Holland in that scene where she's behind the curtain and he's, you know, trying to fix the inhibitor device. And, you know, and the I don't love you scenes were, you know,
good
bits of
and the very clear MacGuffin of him leaving the note at the computer when he left the Punisher's lair. Like, we know she's going to find it because that in real life, that is really the only way she's going to find out all the stuff. It's a very organic, really, like, we don't want to see them have that conversation where he tells her. They just need to have a conversation that she knows, right?
Yes.
And so I think a lot of this, though, has to do with, because who knows what the script development process was like, but I believe I mentioned this on the Odyssey show that I had read something that Tom Holland had spent all the time with Nolan on the Odyssey and came back to the Marvel team and was like, we got to do rewrites on Spider-Man because we got to make it a real movie. Because of his experience of how he had worked with Nolan and saw how Nolan worked in the story development process. And again, could be internet lore. I'm pretty sure I read that in an interview with Tom Holland. But there is clear, like to the scenes we're talking about right now, there is a clear thought process in how characters are speaking to each other, the pace of information, and all of those things, action scenes versus non-action scenes.
I definitely saw a Tom Holland interview where he was talking about his relationship to the director. Now, for me, I actually was kind of aghast at this, but he was saying, I think he refers to his wife as Zed or Zeb, or like it's a shortened.
Yeah.
Let's say it's Zen, right? But he said, and Zen and I just weren't feeling it in this scene. And I was like, are you feeling it? And she was like, no, I'm not feeling it. And so I went to the director and I said, you know, I mean, with respect, we're just kind of not feeling it. And then the director said to us, what are you not feeling? And then we kind of discussed it. And then to his credit, this is what Tom Holland said in this interview. And so he shut down the production for the day and got with the writers and, you know, worked it out and redid the scene. And one part of me was like, oh my God, like if I was the director and the actors were just like, yeah, I don't want to act these lines. And you'd be like, but in another, like, I guess he's earned the right. I mean, I think.
Well, also, I'm sure they had that working relationship set up. I'm sure they had that working relationship set up. I mean, they don't work on these things. I mean, it's a prep is probably a year for this thing. But yeah, I mean, I overall.
Well, this is shutting down production to rewrite.
Oh, no, I get it. I get it. But like, you shut down, you take, you know, if you're the studio executive who has balls, you shut down the production for multiple reasons for the day, you eat it. And then you come back with a stronger movie, ideally, and you make $1 billion opening weekend. Like, you know, there's calculated risks here. Yeah.
I will say that in what seems like in real life, and again, this is, again, you know, us judging from the internet, but in real life, the handoff between Downey Jr., like his character handing off to, quote, the kid, and then also in sort of real life, in terms of the shift of focus from Iron Man to Spider-Man, like the shift of, I mean, I know he's coming back in the next one as Doom, but nevertheless, it does feel like the I think, in fact, the Russo brothers published on social media something saying the mantle has been passed. Like, it definitely feels like that driving force. If you were making from scratch an Avengers film right now, you'd have to place Spider-Man much more prominently in the middle of the story and rather than on the edge of it.
Yeah. Agreed.
Let's talk about the visual effects. Oh, yeah, sorry.
I do also want to profess my love for Florence Pugh and her performance as Black Widow. Is in every movie she's done, from Black Widow to Thunderbolts to what other, I forget however many of these she's been in, she is consistently amazing. She has created such a great character out of that, and her Russian accent is on point. I loved her Russian bath office. It was great.
And it's her sort of, that character's own persona. It's not just a Black Widow Mark II. Yeah. So visual effects wise, there are some, you know, obviously big sequences. I was going to start with that one that we touched on earlier, which is the Spider-Man with the runaway, or perhaps runaway anti-personnel vehicle or whatever it is that's like a tank, really, that's running through the city. So this was famously shot with an actor, I presume it was a stuntman, on cables, leaping around on a wire rig. That was incredibly impressive for him, so that when you had shots down the city, you actually, now it may not have been New York City, Matt, but it was a city.
A city.
Yeah.
You had an actual guy in the air, not not just a kind of a digital double in the air flying through. What do we think of that sequence?
I mean, I think that, you know, it's a great sequence. It's really compelling. There's some great visuals in it. Like, you know, you could see, or I felt like you could see some of the storyboards, right? You could see some concept art images in there, really heroic moments. And you could envision too, probably a highly detailed animatic that was done for that. Like, but it overall was really consistent. I thought it looked really clean. There wasn't stuff in that where I was like, you know, like it's shot in such a way that, like, the tank is or whatever it is, that armored vehicle, like it is sort of, it's mysterious in terms of, like, who's in it, what's going on. It is visualized in the sequence mysteriously too. Like, we don't at first at least get a great look at it. And he's trying to sort of catch up to it and get, you know, and then there's an enormous amount of, if I'm remembering correctly, like some intense physical collisions between the vehicle or vehicles and the Tom Holland Spider-Man that are, like, really violent, but it's in a way that's, like, fitting with the sequence. Well, and that you're not sure he's gonna, like, pull it off.
Punisher doesn't help that either, right? He's in the middle of it firing what looks like bazookoid things at causing poor Spidey to get hurled around at the... Jason, what do you think?
I thought it was a great kind of first big action sequence for the kickoff of the villain introduction, unknowing introduction of the villain. It you know, it ties in well to the, like, he communicates with, I always forget her first name, Zayas, the woman from the bear, who played the police chief. Woman? Yeah, police
chief. Oh, yeah.
And it was a great contextual push. I thought the sequence was really great. It had a lot of momentum. I, of course, immediately begin analyzing everything in the Mike Seymour world of Spider-Man physics. And nothing felt...
We're both infected.
I know, it's true. We're Seymour men now. It all felt really good to me, like, because Spider-Man
What was your verdict?
What? Oh, no, it all felt reasonable to me. Like, it didn't...
See,
it didn't
I'm going to say that it felt reasonable because they had a guy on actual wires.
Right, yeah? Yes.
And so that set the tone of how fast you could jerk things and move things.
They all feel reasonable except the ones where he leaps from a building and hits, like, a terminal velocity.
Yes.
Then shoots a web and then rip swings some. Like, his arms would get... They would just come right out of his socket.
The arc ones... Superpowers. The arc ones make sense, where he's going laterally. where he's swinging like a monkey bars kind of thing. Like, but when you go straight down and then like in the V, doesn't make sense. But he is, he does have super spider strength. And
these
are not human. He's not a human.
I would say there's a high risk factor in his, I'm just going to fall off a building.
Yes.
Shoot a web out and hope that it can get something.
He's kind of going through like Spider-Man puberty in this movie, right? He's like,
Well,
he's getting his like web, his web organic juice. Webs and his black eyeballs. And
was there enough of a payoff for that?
No.
That was like, I felt that was like,
it felt like it never came back where, I guess it sort of does.
Well, it does at the end when he kind of gets like, he
captures all the ninja.
He's like really comes into it.
But still, it wasn't. I expected there to be more of a, like, you know, caterpillar to butterfly. Like it was just like he got the organic web stuff.
It's a version B of what he had to go through in the first movie. It's always the superhero learns his powers gag, right?
Yeah.
Which we got in the first one. He already knows it. It's just it's recalibration as opposed to learning, where he has to. I think it's kind of funny.
There was just an enormous amount of web holding him when he was naked in the alleyway, and an enormous amount in his apartment. And it was like,
I think that's Matt's puberty reference. Yeah.
Oh no, just because it's like is, you just feel like there's going to be a scene where he's like in the bathroom and he's like, oh, I'm in the shower. I'll be in a minute. You know,
it's a bit like that line in Guardians where he's like ultraviolet light or whatever. Look around the here with
that. Howie Mandel wouldn't be on that set. I like the APV or whatever sequence. It felt really natural to me. It felt it's a great place to bring in the Punisher. And to your point, like, and the Punisher hits him with the van. There's like a slight comedic, rubbery kind of like, he's not going to get hurt getting hit by the van, so we're cool. And he like climbs up. Hey, what are you doing? You know, blah, blah, blah. They ride the line between this like maybe slightly more violent where he gets bruised and bloodied and other ones where it's like slightly more comedic.
You know, when they're bantering when Hulk is attacking in later in the film and the two of them are like arguing like crazy, or when they're arguing, I think, in the Punisher's lair. I believe those two sequences were pretty much improv between the two actors.
Oh, really?
They were just,
That's
they
fun.
And it's almost impossible to hear what they're saying when they're referring to some previous, I forget what it was. It was like.
Staten Island.
But they just rain and they're just going at each other constantly. And you're just like, they're acting things out. And you're like, I've got no idea, but it's.
I do just want to say when we're talking about the swinging sequences in particular, like, you know, just to speak broadly about them, I think the ones that for me were really successful and it felt like a fresh perspective is where the camera is like hovering sort of just like off the shoulder of Spider-Man or Spider-Man and Zendaya when they're together. And we're kind of with them moving through this sort of chasm of buildings, you know, like, and it's nighttime and the camera felt like it wasn't static, right? It wasn't like some, you know, fixed, airplane camera locked off on the wing or something. It was like, it was moving a little bit. It felt organic. And the gravity, the movement as they went from one arc to the next, I thought felt really natural. And that perspective was really cool and how they were able to get all the background to work in sync with the movement, I thought was very effective.
On his outfit actually had folds and wrinkles and stuff in it. And of course, you really notice it when he's free falling and you see inside the cowl and you got his eye, which is in the trailer, but also cut to the exterior of that when he's just plummeting down towards and you can see the kind of airflow across his body.
Yeah, I did like the fact that it like literally looked like a dude wearing a suit and not in the Batman kind of, not to hit on knock on Batman, but you know, he's wearing actual armor, but you know, not in the standard superhero, like abs carved into the suit kind of thing. And like when he's walking around, like it, you see the fabric was bunching around his ribs a little bit and his waist. And it like felt like a real thing. I mean, obviously was, but I was going to say in that Zendaya sequence where they're swinging, when they're looking at him, at them directly, the two of them, and she was kind of like, you know, L to him. Her face was in the close up. That one was a little tough for me because you don't have any reference to where they are in space. So really, what it looks like is the background is just doing this, and they're kind of.
I liked it though.
Yeah, I'm not saying I didn't like it, but I was like, wait, what's happening? Like, it was just a little bit of a.
Isn't that what's happening in the plot at that point? Like, hey, what's happening?
Totally. I think it starts in a wider kind of, you know, more establishing shot of she's holding him, he's holding her, and there, which obviously is a whole different plot point of there. She's literally hugging him, which is what he wants, but it's for safety and not for love and all the subtext. I get it. But they're swinging. It felt a little off because I didn't know. It was hard to tell where they were because you couldn't see enough of his body. And so it just, I know it wasn't comped like this, but it felt like the background was moving to show that they were moving.
I just felt it was like, it was an overwhelming sort of sensory overload thing. And that was appropriate at that point in the plot.
Sure.
She wasn't. Hey, I've got a point I want to ask you about. It's a visual effects and a plot point. Okay. So the first thing is, I'm really happy that his suit wasn't the nano glitter disco ball version that he had from Stark earlier, even though it clearly is still a Stark suit. I do find it really odd that he can pull a mask over his head and it miraculously attaches to the main part of the suit and there's no seam line and it just seems to perfectly meld in. But let's assume for a second that it's clever tech that does that, which had been kind of established in the previous film. When he goes to see Black Widow and he has to get into the bath or the sauna bath, whatever it is, naked, and he leaves his mask on, right? What did we think about that? Because for me, either that wasn't Tom's body or it was Tom's body and that was a digital head. Either way, the head to the body was the only effect shot that I was like, what am I looking at here? You know what I'm saying? Huh. He appears with a towel around him. It's her POV looking up at him, his full body, and his head is the mask and the rest of him is
it because the head, did the head like feel scale wise not right? Or like what fell off? Is it because you had this very clearly human physique with like a lollipop kind of thing? Cause there's no contour.
I just felt, okay. So if you contrast that with, Avengers, when they were walking to the time machine, and we know now that they're in those sort of white and red suits.
Yep.
And they didn't on the day have those suits and they were all added digitally. And I looked at that sequence again and I thought, well, what saved them there is that there were collars. So a neck went behind something.
Sure. Yeah.
And so it just felt like I totally bought that they were actually wearing costumes in that shot in Avengers, even though I now know that they didn't have the suits in time. And so all of the characters walking up to the time machine were wearing digital costumes. In this one, though, his neck has to perfectly match with the contour and line of the head sort of cowl because it's skin tight. And so the line from the exterior to the human skin has got to be one continuous curve. It can't have any discontinuity.
It looked like it did have discontinuity, though. It looked like it was kind
of so,
like it sort of was more almost like stretched out. Yeah, like I just thought it was literally like
I was like
that he was just wearing a hood version of the mask. I didn't think it was digital.
That's what it kind of felt like. Yeah.
So it could be that I was seeing the silhouette slightly different because maybe when he's in the digital change his head, narrow it
possibly,
a bit.
Possibly true.
Or they put a digital thing on his head for that sequence because he was worried about the steam or whatever from the bath or whatever. I know that they had clip-on, I think they were magnetic eyepieces that could actually do partial irising, the black around the outside of the eyes. So there were sort of varying levels of that thing. But I don't know, that sequence just bugged me. The only other thing I could think of was that somebody in the grade used Da Vinci's object isolation thing, pinged his head and then maxed up the saturation on the head to make it seem somehow slightly artificial.
Maybe.
I'm surprised it didn't ping for you guys, because I was like, what am I looking at?
Honestly, when he walked out, I was like,
you were just looking at his abs, weren't you?
I was like, how is Tom Holland that big? Like, I mean, he's 30, which I didn't even realize. So, like, you know, he's a man. He's playing a early 20-something-year-old. And I just have never, I mean, he doesn't act with his shirt off very often. And I just was taken aback at how fucking jacked he was in this movie, which is awesome. Like, good for him. But obviously Zendaya's scored on many levels, but you know, I was just like, okay. And also, you know, I don't know. I didn't think there was any visual effects in that scene. I was just watching the scene, because
I'm increasingly noticing that the ability to object isolate in the color grade is causing sometimes people to ping stuff in a way that just makes the scene seem like it's got visual effects when it's probably just a color.
Highly possible, yeah. I mean, it may very well may have some visual effects touch up on it too, because of maybe his hair caused lumps or something,
and they reshaped stuff. I mean, who knows? Thing too,
if I mean, somebody.
If I could,
in one of the scenes, he had like
I don't
when he was
that,
in the water.
Oh, in the water.
I'm talking
about
the. Because in the water is different, right? Because at that point, it's kind of it's a different shot, right?
And it's much closer.
By the way, and just as an aside for those that are listening, I am a fan of Ted Lasso, and I was mortified at the cinematography, green screen, and I think LED walls that were used in the opening episode of the new. I mean, I was shocked. It's very rare that I did this. I literally stopped the show and started looking online to determine what the hell was going on, and discovered that a lot of other people were mortified. It was, I don't know if it was in America, in London, and they tried to make it look like it was in Kansas, or they went to Kansas and only had a work experience kit to do the cinematography. Like. I mean, it is just some of the most. It's not. It's if you watch this episode and you're not aghast, then I'd be stunned. Anyone listening to this podcast that watches that episode and is not stunned would be shocking.
I was saved from this atrocity by never liking nor watching any or other than the first episode of Ted Lasso season one. So I feel
just watch
good
the
about
first
that.
Minute and a half. He's in a supermarket.
Yeah,
and there are scenes that I swear to God, like a student film, Matt, would do, and you would look at it and go, yeah, no, mate, this is not how it works.
I believe shot in your town, Mike, Colin from Accounts. You seen that one? So sweet.
Anyway. Yes. Very, very famous Australian export.
Yeah, it's good.
It's what I call embarrassing comedy. Like you watch it, but you're kind of constantly cringing, but in a good way. You're like, no, don't do that.
Great.
Yeah. That like
that shot where he discovers her in the car.
That's an aside.
And you go, no, please, no, it's so embarrassing. Yeah. Yeah. No visual effects.
Like that show, Staff Let's Flats. I think that's a good one too.
Yeah. It's a British there are film. Some shows ever since a kid that I've liked watching, but it's like watching, for me, it's my version of horror. It's like watching you know, a character that you really care about just doing something that's not in their own best interest, that's really embarrassing. And you go, no, please don't do that. No, oh, that hurts so much. Now maybe I'm just susceptible to being an embarrassment, but
yeah. Can we talk about two things? One, probably isn't visual effects, although there may have been digital doubles. And the other one is really, they're both about Jean Grey, about Sadie Sink's character.
Yep.
After the sequence you mentioned, the APV one, we don't learn who that it's Sadie Sink yet, but we learn that it's that there's this jumping sort of ability, which I thought was super cool. I had not seen that before in that. Like, it was a very visual and cool way to show like an entity moving within reason across, you know, people, which makes it really hard to find and track and chase and whatever. I thought the I believe there was a choreographer specifically for that movement that I saw in the credits. I thought that was it's a great visual gag. Again, seems like it's mostly physical, like body motion, but there must have been some wide digital doubles at some point, maybe. I don't know. But tying that into the actual, you know, when we know that it's Sadie Sink doing it and Jean Grey rather, and the sequence that we see later where she creates the big bubble, kind of soap bubble, psychic bubble. I thought that was really cool. I'm a sucker for chromatic aberration gags.
Yeah, it's
nice. I think Ant-Man was one of my favorites with how he shrunk and got bigger with those cool chromatically aberrated things. But did anyone else feel like it felt to me like it was an intentional nod, that sequence of people freezing and creating that bubble was a intentional nod to Professor X's freakouts in Logan? Because of course he's an expert telepath. She is also. And it seemed too wildly unlikely that it wouldn't have been referenced from that in some capacity.
But that had also been established in one of the earlier X-Men films where
I don't recall.
Wolverine's the only guy that can climb up to her when she's having a...
Okay, so... And so then that too, but...
So I think it's lore for the sort of thing that they do with her character.
Oh, totally. Yeah, I mean, I know they can do it.
It's a bit like Star Trek when it jumps to hyperspace. Everybody does a slightly different version, but you kind of want the streaking.
I didn't recall the X-Men version because I don't remember.
It's like the third X-Men film, and she goes off the reservation, and then she's destroying
Dark Phoenix,
and
only Famke Janssen.
Yeah, only Wolverine can climb a kind of hill to get to her.
Yeah, but I really liked that sequence because I think that's the first sequence of like scale, because they say she can only jump 33 feet and like whatever. And of course you have the destruction things that are bigger, but from a single person creating a thing that you have to get to and stop, that was like the big scale moment.
East River and Roosevelt Island.
I thought it was really nicely done.
Sort of, it reminded me of the shimmer in, Alex Garland movie, what was that called? Annihilation. Yeah, it kind of had a similar soap bubbly kind of look to it.
Oh, Annihilation. Yeah.
That was the only aspect of it I didn't like, that there was a hard edge to it. And that hard edge, you know, the Punisher walks up to and war. I felt like it would be,
Go ahead, Mike.
Oh, just that, you know, like it would have been nicer if it was a sort of a up ahead. It's all stopped. Don't go down there because
it had more undulation.
Like the edge of a gas cloud as opposed to the edge of, or a cloud.
Just a blurrier. Yeah. Yeah.
Rather than a rigid line.
That's fair.
A rigid line looks to me like it's got control, like the specificity of the line indicates that I'm controlling it rather than I have only this much control and then it stops at a particular point within 2 mil and either side of the 2 mil barrier.
Yes, I could see both sides. I think it's probably visually easier to have a hard line that really... from a design standpoint, for the shot design, I do agree that probably having a little more of a wavy kind of like, you know, undulating thing where maybe you would have like, you know,
you did
someone
have
paused
the,
and then
the
someone
not,
but someone 3 feet ahead because the bubble was uneven,
owner, which
kind of thing.
That was kind of funny. And then Mike, you had to go take your dog for a walk this morning before we could record.
Maybe
you got stuck in the bubble.
Yeah. Minor plot point for the annoying, like this is the Comic-Con kind of complaint, you know. But it's okay to fire bullets into that
frozen
space.
Well, we do have the Punisher
the
character, the Gulf
like
of Fragile Masculinity character who solves every problem with a gun, of course. What about, do you guys want to talk a little bit about the updated Hulk effect?
100%.
That's exactly what I wanted to get to. Interestingly, plot-wise, he's not the one that was in Avengers where he's like, I've worked out how to reconcile the two sides of me and I'm going to take selfies with
fans. The first one was because he's talking to him. He's talking to him in the first – because he's two Hulks, right? He's like a medium-sized Hulk with clothes, regular clothes, and then he's like giganto, awesome Hulk. after that.
But my point is,
it's all done with a device like on his Spider-Man arm, which wasn't something that we'd kind of
for.
And Jean Grey to try to shut her off or whatever. But
yeah.
But I thought the there were a couple cool moments. The first was that there's like the initial almost transition, and we're seeing Mark Ruffalo kind of from one side, and there's all like a rush of color that kind of goes up his neck, and it looks like, I mean, it might have been a 3D effect. It almost looked like a 2D effect, although I think it actually is he's more hulkish at that moment. But it looked really cool. It was like that. It was almost like a cuttlefish. I don't know if you've ever seen like the
cuttlefish. He's getting bigger while it's happening.
Shimmer with their lights, you know, kind of like the skin changing color as like either a mating thing or to ward off predators. It almost had that kind of look to it as it sort of whipped across his side. And I thought that was really cool. And the way they were able to retain so much more of the actor too, like the sculpt of the larger head and face and the hair details, I thought were really strong. And when, I think you mentioned it earlier, when he does go to like the super big, like, oh, I didn't know you could get that big version of him. It did look really, really cool and menacing, you know, as a character.
It was so cool. I went by myself last night in the theater because my kid's in Greece right now with his friends.
So I thought you were saying they were watching Greece last night.
They were watching Greece too. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. No, so I was like by myself in the IMAX by my house. And of course, I didn't I see Mark Ruffalo earlier.
Wait, stop. Just got to unpack this. You actually found an IMAX that wasn't playing Odyssey, that was playing Spider-Man?
Yes, and it's not Giganto IMAX. But I literally happened to look at my thing and there were two tickets left, two disparate seats. And I was like, I'm going to get that one seat, which was off center, but decent. And I was I love the Hulk. He's my dude. And when we saw the initial Hulk in the clothes, I was like, oh, it's Smart Hulk, you know, sort of. Because that's what we last saw, and it's a whole thing. But man, like you said, when he goes like Giganto Hulk, I was literally in my seat being like, oh my God, this is so awesome. Like he was like the sculpt was great, the like dirty skin for, you know, like all the skin texture, the when they go behind him and all the muscle textures and everything that bumped out and he got so gigantic. Like it all looked totally spot on for scale, for size, for imposing. And of course, no cinema and none of the movies have we seen the Hulk that big. And I believe that is that is one of the most comic accurate Hulks in terms of like big, gigantic Hulk. And that sequence, that entire fight sequence, I was like, I need to watch this like 100 times because it was.
Can I just say that is so much more successful, that this is the most forgettable Marvel film. The Captain America, what's it called? Captain America, like Brave New World or whatever it is.
Oh, yeah, the Red Hulk.
The Red Hulk. Like that Hulk, I was bored watching him. I mean, I literally was like, I wish I wasn't in the cinema when I was watching that version. That Red Hulk.
What did you think about this Hulk?
Well, that's what I'm saying. This is such a different contrast. Like,
yeah,
it's an interesting problem when you've got, I missed the personality of annoyed kind of slightly simple Hulk where he's like, you know, hate stairs, you know, Hulk hates stairs, you know. I like that kind of version of the Hulk where he's kind of just cognitive enough to make wisecracks and be annoyed by people treating him poorly, which is not relevant here because of course he was possessed. But I found, like it's you watch the different versions of the Hulk and it's often the case that the head is like kind of ridiculously small and then the frontal lats and the back lats and the front of the chest is just so enormously big, but that would actually stop you from moving your arms around. In fact, I've actually been to a gym where there was a guy who, as I'm sure, was on massive steroids, and he tried operating the cash register, and he couldn't bring both hands together in the front of his body, so he'd have to actually twist at the waist, and he'd turn and press one button, and then turn the other arm to get the other hand to get to the cash register. He was literally pivoting at the waist, and I was like, dude, you're just really unfortunate that you've had this accident, that you've taken so many steroids that you can't now... Yeah, it looked like he couldn't clap. He couldn't get his arms together at the front.
Yeah, for sure. So,
he had really tiny legs. All the time.
Everyone skips legs. Nobody likes legs. Those. Sorry. Anyway, my point is, it was good.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you guys too that you mentioned, Mike, the thing about the cowl in the Russian bath sequence. But one other thing that we saw a couple times I thought was kind of tough as an effect shot, and I don't know if it's just me, and I think it maybe is part of where I kind of felt like this sort of claustrophobia watching the film, that I felt like a lot of it was they were trying to kind of make me feel like I was somewhere that clearly it wasn't, was when there's the boat, the dry dock boat area on that pier where Punisher character has his little hideout. And we have a couple of moments where we're inside and we're looking out through the opening.
Yeah.
And the visage of the city, it's like this, you know, rosy pink and orange kind of sherberty sunset on the city. And it just does not, it did not look real. I don't know if it was an LED thing or if it was just a comp.
I think it's a great comp thing. Like, I think that this is this habit of like getting perfect clouds, perfect sunset, perfect lighting. It just doesn't resonate.
It felt hot to me. Like it didn't feel like it definitely was hot, like, which it should be
approaching.
It's tricky, right? It's the car scenario, right? Like there would be so much light coming into that.
And it doesn't space, reflect it.
But it didn't feel like there was any wrap. It was like very hard. I mean, it's a beautifully shot interior, but to have that large of an opening exterior, it didn't
bounce. That was what I think killed me in a lot of the other sequences. There's no bounce ambience. Light anywhere. And there'd be so much bounce light. Everything would be elevated. And a lot of the set stuff felt like it was lit, you know, for the actors and for drama. Without an idea of what the sky is going to be.
But when you see the cross shot looking at the, like if you were standing looking at the postcard, you know, opening, if you look to your left, when they shoot to the left, when Punisher comes out on the boat, that boat is black, but it's like aged and shiny. And you see a huge glare reflection, you know, diffused reflection on the hull. So it's like we know there's light coming in, but in specifically that like looking out shot, you don't feel it. You don't feel that light entering.
I'd almost say that sometimes the stuff they're shooting, where they're replacing the skyline and stuff like that. I think the mistake that I felt like I was seeing over and over again that took me out of the space a little bit was that lack of bounce light and the background replacements or the extensions that to make it more New York for whatever set they had built, they did not integrate well together in terms of the lighting. Like the lighting often on the set was kind of flat and then the lighting was much more dramatic on the background and then it made it feel artificial.
But let me ask you this though. Do you think it's really necessarily the DOP's lighting or the grading in the colorist's hands? Because I'm starting to think that we're criticizing sometimes visual effect shots, whereas there must be a visual effect shot guy listening to this or a woman listening to this going, not my fault, the shot looked great on my monitor.
That's totally possible. I'm more than willing to grant that possibility.
Yeah, of course.
But I'm just saying, like, you know, one of the things we talk about a lot on here is, well, why didn't it work? Like, what was it that threw it off?
Yeah.
And I'm not putting blame on the effects artist or on the grader or on the DP or any of that. I don't know. I mean, I wasn't there. I'm just looking at it as an audience member and seeing certain things that I feel like don't quite work. And it's that, you know, it tended to be, I think, the same thing as in that dock where the background was very bright, the artificial background. And then the foreground where our actors are was more neutral or which I lots mean, of contrast kind of makes sense, right? I mean, it's going to be more contrasty closer to camera, an atmospheric haze. It's going to be depth cueing and all that stuff.
But there was no atmospheric haze. Yeah, and it just
never, and the direction, the directional lighting never felt the same. Like, you know, if you're in New York and the sun is moving across the sky, like you get a lot of hard shadows and you do have a really intense directional mm-hmm. light through the course of a given day. And the diffuse light, like, you know, it's cool if you're going to do it that way, but then well, the background needs to look as diffuse.
I think for me, it's two things in color. I think it's one, it's saturation. Like it's the saturation is more than it should be with the depth cueing. Yeah. And then also you should limit the palette in the distance. So as you go off into the distance, there should just be less range of colors. Yep. The most obvious example is if you're shooting underwater and you move away from the camera, it all goes to like blue tones, mm-hmm. right? But there's a similar version that happens in daylight. The stuff way in the distance just doesn't have the range of color and it doesn't have the saturation of color that you do. Lifted. And yet I think people go, well, that's a really beautiful shot of New York. Well, I know it is, but you should degrade it, dude. So, yeah. I mean, it was much better than the Punisher TV show or the Daredevil TV show where everything was really black and dark and felt like it was almost, well, you know, the days of our lives.
The shots the Marvel after version. Sunset. Like, so if it's nighttime, like it works so much better because anything that it's lit for night on the set and then it's lit for night in the background, mm-hmm. just the ability to integrate those things, starting with like, you know, getting your blacks to match, like it just totally works. Like, and there isn't that need for a direct, like anything. I mean, it's sort of the classic thing, right? Like, I mean, although it's gotten so much better in the last, you know, 20 years, but anytime you do CG stuff and it's bright sunlight is usually the hardest thing to make look mm-hmm. good, you know?
Yeah.
Or used to be at least.
Yeah.
I do want to point out some small details that I really liked, both executional and design.
Yep.
All of the webs that he shoots out of his wrist, the organic webs, were the McFarlane, this is super deep comic stuff, but that was the McFarlane design, Todd McFarlane's, the way he drew the webs. And they have, it's like, it almost has like a barbed wire mm-hmm. vibe. So it's like the stream of the web and these little, you know, sort of things that curl around them.
Yeah, they looked really cool. That was a good look, the design and the execution.
Yeah. And it really showed up well in that Hulk sequence when the camera kind of craned up over the Hulk to see that all of those bricks didn't fall, pieces of the building were holding the Hulk. And you're climbing up those webs. You could really see it. They were glinting in the sun. You could see all the little curly cue barbed wire things. And I thought that was a really nice touch that worked both as the fan service thing, but also as a design execution thing where it differentiated them from the chemical webs, at least for me.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a great thing. I think I said earlier about the comic covers. Did we talk about that? The comic covers in the
I think the mix too of the practical on set webbing and the digital, whether it's the chemical or the organic webbing. Yeah, I mean, mm-hmm. it's a good thing to bring up because it is a cool effect, and the design and execution of both are both different, mm-hmm. but also looking, they both looked really cool.
Yeah, I was going to say one of the sequences that I applaud for its simplicity and giving the audience credit for being able to decode cinematic language was the instances where he was remembering the discussion with May and then swapped who was in that discussion. And then he was in the room. And like, I just felt that was sometimes in these films that they feel like, well, we have to really make it clear what's going on. We'll put like a virtual Vaseline around the edge of the lens or we'll do something. So we all know what this isn't real and this is like mm-hmm. interpreted. And in that, it was just like, yeah, you guys are clever. You get it. You understand what's going on. We don't need to do anything else here. Let the actors just act and convey
in
the scene.
Stretched room, you know, it's really nice.
They shot it straight and like it was the, you know, poignant moment of real, I feel like I've been saying this every show recently, but of pathos where we really feel that we totally understand the the mm-hmm. tragedy of the Jean Grey character, and it's conveyed through this, you know, really sweet performance by the 59-year-old, I believe, Marissa Tomei, mm-hmm. who still looks like she's in her, you know, 30s.
I'm 40s. So glad she won the Oscar for My Cousin Vinny.
Oh yeah.
But I just feel like it's great that
it's a perfect film. Yeah. My Cousin Vinny is a perfect film.
She's solid.
It is. It's a great film. She's great in it. And I'm glad that a comedy got acting chop recognition. Yeah. I mean, she totally deserved it, but also she just seems like, you know, a great actress who could otherwise have missed out on that moment in the Oscar sun.
She's great in all the movies she's been in.
Yeah. Yeah, it was nice to see her coming back. And also, I thought it was restraint on behalf of the filmmakers not to feel like they had to bring in all the other characters from the other films for, like, you know, the classic one in Crocodile Dundee is he makes a great joke about that's not a knife, this is a knife. And then they felt mm-hmm. they had to keep going back, remaking that same joke in every other sequel that happened. So here, you didn't get a lot of Ned, which is, I didn't think we needed him, but because we needed Spider-Man to be isolated, to be miserable, and so you can't have a lot of his buddy. But then, you know, that annoying character that was the guy that was taking credit for being a friend of Spider-Man but actually was just a pain in the ass from the earlier films? He was kind of a classmate that was...
Flash.
And they just said, I don't know what his name was, but they were just like, we didn't need him, and they didn't feel the need to have to include him so that... Because it's like, when you do that, I feel like it's a greatest hits thing where you go, well, that character was kind of got some laughs, so we have to have him as well.
But they used Ned in a great way in that they brought mm-hmm. back, like, through the drawing that mm-hmm. Zendaya, MJ's character does where she draws them as you look like best friends. That was sweet. And then they sort of tie it back in at the
end. He does the handshake.
He sees him and he goes and, they have that moment.
Oh, I thought he was appropriately used.
Like, and he's like,
but, you know, like sometimes you feel like they have to. Yeah,
it was good. But it was that idea of, like, the reestablishment of important relationships and friendships.
I did love the Spidey tracker. I thought that was like a cute joke because super low. And I like that they showed the Punisher using it. Like, how do you know where I am? He's like, I got tools. They cut to his Spidey tracker. You know, it's like, it's funny.
Yeah.
That is actually on the internet and it shows you all the premieres and stuff that,
that's
where they turned up. Hey, Jason, you're the guy to ask for those of us that are curious, what the heck was the post-credit sequence saying?
It was the Spidey tracker and it showed like the Spidey icon going out into space, basically. So
it didn't show out in space. It just moved to space and then found it in the space.
Yes. So I am guessing that it is probably, I assumed it was a tie to Secret Wars because that's where they all end up on another planet.
Is that right? I didn't. What happens in Secret Wars? I thought that was
Secret Wars. Earth, one is a character called the Beyonder brings all of the Marvel heroes and villains to a planet, like a battle planet, where they fight. And it's he's an omnipotent being that can do anything, and he
sounds like an episode
brings
of Star
him
Trek,
there.
Yeah.
Brings him there to fight, and that's where Spider-Man meets the symbiote for the first time, which is an alien creature that he attaches to him. He gets the black suit. That's where the black suit comes from. It's the symbiote. And then he goes back to Earth. It goes to Eddie Brock and becomes Venom. That's how Venom comes from the Secret Wars. Secret Wars.
What would we do with
Secret Wars 2? I am not that familiar with. And I had read that there was a Secret Wars 2 was what they were going for. And remember, in space, we have like Dr. Doom that can do all sorts of stuff. And we have Galactus because we're all in the same universe now. I don't know. I personally do not know why Spider-Man would go out into space unless it's to meet or be taken to a place with all the other people.
And remember, in space, no one can hear you scream.
Exactly.
Safety alert for anybody who wasn't sure.
But yes, I was curious. I was watching that and I was like, I don't know about this. But it's fine.
I missed it. I forgot to stay till the end. I missed the post credits.
The movie
scene.
Was really? Good enough for me.
Well, so you didn't see the sex scene. Well, I'm surprised at that, Matt. Spidey baby. Okay. Well, I don't understand it either, but I'm sure. Well, actually, I'm not even sure. There are a lot of post-credit sequences that never came back to be something. You know, like you'd see a post-credit sequence and you'd think.
The best one ever was them at the shawarma shop.
Yes, that's the best one.
In the first Avengers, that's the best. They as far as I'm concerned, that was it. They broke the bank. That was good. Like, you didn't need to ever do another one.
Yeah.
Yes, that was very, very good. But yes, there was a sort of, there have been ones where if you like looked at them and then you think, oh, that kills me. And there's like, no, that's got nothing to do with any film that's come after it. I think in Guardians of the Galaxy, they have a sequence of somebody giving birth to somebody or producing somebody. And it's never been ever mentioned ever again. And it's like, what? What was all that about? So, Well, guys, it's been fun discussing it. I got to say, I have no first-hand knowledge, but Tom Holland just seems like a nice guy. I'm kind of happy for him that he's going so well.
He's about as likable
a guy as you could possibly imagine for
He intentionally chose not to live in LA to avoid the nonsense of Hollywood. So I think that's part of it.
Yeah,
he's very smart. I've got to say, very successful person.
It's nice that Zendaya has her own major franchise in June, so it's not like, you know, there's an imbalance there, because you always think that's got to be hard when, you know.
Did you guys get that trailer? I did not.
No.
Show?
Looks good?
Yeah.
Looks, the new trailer of that one looks, I'm so up for
June's
that.
June's sort like of your, yeah.
Yeah.
I like to
I see June as kind of your kind of, it's more serious sci-fi and more educated cinematography and filmmaking.
It's more misanthropic.
I was going to say that I don't remember. So there you go.
Well, at least it's,
Gene Grey got to you.
So anyway, thanks so much for being here, guys. Thanks so much for listening. We've got, I guess we're now at the tail end of the US summer. So that's kind of, I don't know if there are any big blockbusters still left to come.
The end of House, other than June. The end of Oak Street or whatever, the Bad Robot, J.J. Abrams.
Oh, the J.J. Abrams.
Is J.J. Well, directed by the guy who did It Follows. It's a JJ produced joint, but the Anne Hathaway
and it's
Ewan McGregor with the dinosaurs.
Ewan McGregor.
I am making a claim and assuming that this will be folded into the Cloververse. That is my assumption.
Okay.
I mean, it's a great idea. Yeah. Like, you know, the Jurassic Park in a suburban neighborhood. Like, that's a great idea. It's like, who doesn't want to see that?
Yeah, it looks cool.
That sounds fun.
Well, as I said, I'm hanging out for June with Matt, so looking forward to that one. And I will also say there's been a lot of really good television stuff happening lately as well. So other than
Widow's
the
Bay,
cinematography and Ted Lasso.
Widow's Bay. Everyone needs to watch Widow's Bay.
Yes, Widow's Bay. And some very good dragon effects in otherwise a fairly lackluster season of not lackluster series perhaps. Okay, well, we need to discuss that in an upcoming show, but for now, thanks so much for listening, guys, and we'll see you on the flip side. Thanks, guys. Bye.
Thanks.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com. copyright FX Guide LLC.